practical applications of positivism. The practical applications of this philosophy are very serious. Positivism claims the right of absolute and universal control over all human affairs, over education, politics, social organization, and religion. As the progress of science has banished all liberty of opinion or of action from the departments of mathematics and astronomy, so it must banish it from every other department of human thought and activity. Speaking of liberty of conscience, Kant says negative as we now see this dogma to be, signifying release from old authority, while waiting for the necessity of positive science, the absolute character supposed to reside in it gave it energy to fulfill its revolutionary destination. This dogma can never be an organic principle. And, moreover, it constitutes an obstacle to reorganization, now that its activity is no longer absorbed by the demolition of the old political order. Can it be supposed, he asks, that the most important and the most delicate conceptions, and those which by their complexity are accessible to only a small number of highly prepared understandings, are to be abandoned to the arbitrary and variable decisions of the least competent minds? 195. This argument is conclusive. If social life, the acts of men, are as much and as certainly determined by physical laws as material changes, those who have ascertained these laws are entitled to control all other men. As it would be preposterous to allow men to build our houses or navigate our ships who would not obey the laws of nature, so it would be absurd, on this hypothesis, to allow those ignorant of social laws to govern society. Kant avows his admiration, not of popish doctrine, but of the papal organization, which in the new order of things he proposes to continue. Papal infallibility, he says, 196 was a great intellectual and social advance. Professor Huxley pithily characterizes positivism, in this regard, as Catholicism minus Christianity. Religion is not excepted from this absolute subjection. The positive philosophy, as it denies the existence of the soul and the being of God, would seem to leave no place for religion. Kant placed on the title page of his Discours sur l'ensemble du positivisme, the announcement that his design was to reorganize society sans Dieu ni roi. Nevertheless, as men must have, as they always have had, some religion, a philosophy which aspired to absolute dominion over all the departments of human life, must make some provision for this universal, although imaginary, necessity of our nature. Kant, therefore, published a catechism of religious belief, and a ritual of religious worship. The object of worship was to be the aggregate of humanity formed by the absorption of the successive generations of men. Every great man has two forms of existence, one conscious before death, the other after death, unconscious, in the hearts and intellects of other men. The God of the positive philosophy is, therefore, the aggregate of the memories of great men. Undoubtedly, says Huxley, Dieu disappeared, but the nouveau grand resupre, a gigantic fetish, turned out brand new by M. Kant's own hands, reigned in his stead. Roy also was not heard of. But in his place I found eminently defined social organization, which, if it ever came into practice, would exert a despotic authority such as no sultan has revolved, and no Puritan presbytery in its palmiest days could hope to excel. While, as for the cult Christ et ideal humanitae, in my blindness, could not distinguish it from sheer popery, with M. Kant in the chair of St. Peter, and the names of most of the saints changed. 197. There are, however, to be two forms of worship, the one private, the other public. The special object of the former is woman, because she is the most perfect representative of humanity. As mother, she excites veneration. As wife, affection, and as daughter, kindness. To excite these sentiments, ideal woman is to be worshipped. Humanity, or the memory of great men, is the object for public worship, regarding which many details are given. The new religion is to have 10 sacraments, a peculiar architecture, and an extended hierarchy, under the control of one absolute high priest. Such is the system which Kant was allowed to believe would supersede the gospel of Jesus Christ. It has already almost passed away. Among the advanced men of science in England there is scarcely one so poor as to do it reverence. 198. E. Scientific Materialism. Leading Principles. the leading principles of the modern scientific form of materialism are embraced, by some at least, who do not consider themselves materialists. They, however, adopt the language of the system, and avow principles which, in the generally accepted meaning, constitute what in the history of human thought is known as materialism. The most important of these principles are the following, many of which, however, are not peculiar to the system. 1. Matter and force are inseparable. Wherever there is matter, there is force, and wherever there is force, there is matter. This proposition, at least in the first instance, is to be understood only of physical force. 2. All physical forces, such as light, heat, chemical affinities, electricity, magnetism, etc., etc., are convertible. Light may be converted into heat, and heat into light. Ether into electricity, and electricity into ether. And so through the whole range. This is what is called the correlation of forces. Count Rumford, in a communication to the Royal Society of London, in 1798, satisfied that the heat generated in boring cannon could not be otherwise accounted for, advanced the doctrine that heat is a peculiar mode of motion. Since then the doctrine has been generalized, and it is now the commonly received opinion that all the physical forces are resolvable into motion. This generalization, however, is not accepted by all scientific men. They find it impossible to conceive how gravitation, which acts instantaneously at all distances, can heat motion. It is simply a force which tends to produce motion. 3. This motion, however, is not of a fluid, or ether, or any other imponderable substance peculiar to each particular kind of force. As sound consists in, or rather is produced by the vibrations of the atmosphere, it was natural to assume that light was the undulation of one medium, heat of another, electricity of another. This theory is discarded. The motion intended is motion in the molecules of the matter affected. When iron is heated, nothing is added to it. There is no imponderable substance called caloric. All that occurs is that the molecules of the iron are agitated in a particular way. If the iron be magnetized, it is only a different kind of motion imparted to its constituent atoms. So of all other kinds of force. When, however, light or heat is radiated from a distant object, the motion which constitutes these forces must be transmitted through some medium. For where there is motion, there must be something that moves. And, therefore, if heat be motion in the molecules of the sun, that heat could not reach us unless there was some material medium between us and the sun. 4. The physical forces are not only convertible one into any of the others, but they are quantitatively equivalent. That is, a given amount of heat will produce an amount of light or of electricity, or of any other force, which, if it could be utilized, would reproduce precisely that amount of heat. A cannonball, when it impinges on a target, produces heat enough to give it the velocity which it had at the moment of contact. A certain amount of light and heat derived from the sun is expended in the formation of a certain amount of wood or coal. That amount of wood or coal will furnish precisely the amount of light and heat which was expended in its production. Count Rumford experimented to determine the quantitative relation between motion and heat, and arrived at very nearly the same conclusion as that reached by Dr. Joule of Manchester, England, who found that 1 pound of matter, falling 772 feet, will produce heat enough to raise the temperature of a pound of water 1 degree of Fahrenheit. This is now received as the unit of force. 5. Force is indestructible. It is never increased or diminished. What is lost in one form is taken up in another. Forces are, therefore, indestructible, convertible, and imponderable agents. This correlation and conservation of forces is declared by Dr. Carpenter, the eminent physiologist, to be now amongst the best established generalizations of physical science, and the greatest scientific triumph of the age. Thanks, as he says, to the labors of Faraday, Grove, Joule, Thomson, and Tyndall, to say nothing of those of Helmholtz and other distinguished continental savants. 199. Correlation of the physical and vital forces. So long as this doctrine of the correlation of forces is confined to the department of physics, it is a purely scientific question, in which the theologian has no special interest. Unhappily, it has not been thus confined. Dr. Carpenter, in the paper just quoted, says, "Every thoughtful physiologist must desire to see the same course of inquiry thoroughly pursued in regard to the phenomena of living bodies." 200 The first step in that direction, he adds, was taken by Dr. Mayer of Germany, in his remarkable treatise on organic movement and its relation to material changes. There appear to be three forms of opinion among scientific men, of the advanced school, as to the relation between vital and physical forces. First, there are some, of whom Dr. Carpenter is one, who hold that the forces by which vital processes are carried in, are light, heat, electricity, and so forth, but that these are directed or controlled by a force of a different kind, called a directing agency. Dr. Carpenter's theory. Dr. Carpenter denies that there is any such thing as vitality, or vital force, or nisus formativus, or Bildungstrieb. Two germs may be selected between which neither the microscope nor chemical analysis can detect the slightest difference. Yet one develops into a fish, another into a bird. Why is this? Dr. Carpenter answers because of a directing agency residing in the germ. His language is the prevalent opinion has until lately been, that this power is inherent in the germ, which has been supposed to derive from its parent not merely its material substance, but a nisus formativus, Bildungstrieb, or germ force, in virtue of which it builds itself up into the likeness of its parent, and maintains itself in that likeness until the force is exhausted, and at the same time imparting a fraction of it to each of its progeny. 201 This opinion he rejects, but adds, when we look carefully into the question, we find that what the germ really supplies, is not the force, but the directive agency. Thus rather resembling the control exercised by the superintendent builder, who is charged with working out the design of the architect, than the bodily force of the workmen who labor under his guidance in the construction of the fabric. 202 The conclusion at which he arrives is that the correlation between heat and the organizing force of plants is not less intimate than that which exists between heat and motion. The special attribute of the vegetable germ is its power of utilizing, after its own peculiar fashion, the heat which it receives, and of applying a constructive power to the building of its fabric after its characteristic type. 203. On this doctrine of Carpenter it may be remarked, 1. That it seems to be self-contradictory. He denies to the germ nisus formativus, or Bildungstrieb, and attributes to it a constructive power. What is the difference? The English phrase is a literal translation of the German word. 2. He says that heat and the organizing force of plants are correlated, that is, they are convertible one into the other and are quantitatively equivalent. And yet the relation between them is analogous to that between the superintending builder and the strength of the workman. According to this, the physical strength of the hod man is convertible into the intellect of the builder and is its quantitative equivalent. We do not see how this contradiction is to be avoided, unless he uses the phrases constructive force, organizing force, sometimes for the directing agency in the germ, and sometimes, for the physical forces which that agency controls. But if he distinguishes between the directing agency and the organizing force, then there is no correlation between the physical force and the vital activity of the germ. 3. According not only to the common, but to the latest, opinion of physiologists, the germ supplies something more than a directing agency which must itself be a force. It not only directs, but it affects, or produces changes. It is an operative force, acting not by, but against physical forces or chemical affinities, counteracting them as long as it continues. As soon as the germ or plant or tissue dies, the physical forces obtain ascendancy and disintegration takes place. This Dr. Carpenter himself admits. The most marked characteristic, he says, which distinguishes vital from every kind of physical activity, is the fact that a germ endowed with life develops itself into an organism of a type resembling that of its parent. That this organism is the subject of incessant changes, which all tend, in the first place, to the evolution of its typical form, and subsequently to its maintenance in that form, notwithstanding the antagonism of chemical and physical agencies, which are continually tending to produce its disintegration. But that, as its term of existence is prolonged, its conservative power declines so as to become less and less able to resist these disintegrating forces, to which it finally succumbs, leaving the organism to be resolved by their agency into the components from which its materials were originally drawn. 204. This does not mean that chemical agencies have no power to act in the growth and development of plants and animals, but it certainly does mean that the vital force or life is an agency or power different from any kind of physical force. Life and physical force, therefore, are not identical. They are not correlated. The former is not a mere form of the latter. One of the most eminent of living physiologists is Dr. John Marshall, and he, although far from belonging to the old school, distinctly takes the ground that there is a vital force which cannot be resolved into any of the physical forces operative in the external, inorganic world. He says 205 all the strictly physical processes within the body, whether chemical, mechanical, thermic, electric, or photic, are performed by modifications of the common force which produces similar phenomena in the inorganic world around us. There exists, however, in the living animal, as in the living vegetable organism, a special formative or organizing energy, evolving the perfect animal or plant from the primitive ovum or ovule, developing its various tissues and organs, and conserving them from the commencement to the termination of its individual existence. The influence of this force, moreover, extends from the parent to the offspring, generation after generation. This is the commonly received doctrine, that physical phenomena are to be referred to physical forces, vital phenomena to vital force, and mental phenomena to mind. The new doctrine, however, is that all phenomena are to be referred to physical forces, no other forces being either known or knowable. The more advanced opinions. The second view adopted in reference to the relation of physical to vital force, is, that if there be any difference it cannot be known. Physical forces are known. They can be measured. They can not only be converted one into another, but can be proved to be quantitatively equivalent. If any other kind of force be assumed to account for vital phenomena, the assumption is gratuitous. It is taking for granted that something exists of which we know, and can know nothing. It must, therefore, lie beyond the sphere of science and is of no importance. Even Dr. Carpenter uses such language as this: another class of reasoners have cut the knot which they could not untie, by attributing all the actions of living bodies for which physics and chemistry cannot account, to a hypothetical vital principle. A shadowy agency that does everything in its own way, but refuses to be made the subject of scientific examination. Like the odd force, or the spiritual power to which the lovers of the marvelous are so fond of attributing the mysterious movements of turning and tilting tables. 206 If a man asks me, says Professor Huxley, what the politics of the inhabitants of the moon are, and I reply, that I do not know. That neither I, nor anyone else, have any means of knowing. And that, under these circumstances, I decline to trouble myself about the subject at all. I do not think he has any right to call me a skeptic. 207 It is thus he banishes vitality from the sphere of science, because everything, except matter and its functions, belongs to the region of the unknown and the unknowable. Professor Tyndall and Herbert Spencer take, at times, the same ground. But, although such writers as Dr. Carpenter, in apparent contradiction to their own admissions, acknowledge the existence of a directing agency in the living germ, the majority of the writers of this school refuse to recognize any such agency or force as a scientific truth. The only difference between the second and third views on this general subject, above referred to, is, that according to the one, the assumption of vital is distinct from physical force, is regarded as gratuitous and unnecessary. According to the other, any such assumption is declared to be unphilosophical, and to be utterly discarded. The same writer sometimes takes one, and sometimes the other of these grounds. The argument for the correlation of physical and vital forces. Thus Professor Huxley, although a few years since a firm advocate of vital, as distinct from physical force, in his discourse on the physical basis of life, takes the opposite ground. The argument is this: the elements furnished by the mineral kingdom are taken up by the plant, and, under the influence of light and heat, transformed into organized matter. The products of vegetation, starch, sugar, fibrin, etc., are purely material. This is true even of protoplasm, or living matter, or the physical basis of life, as it is called, which is elaborated by the plant out of the lifeless materials furnished by the soil and the atmosphere. There is indeed a great difference between the products of vegetation and the lifeless elements out of which they are formed. But so there is between the elements of water and water itself. If an electric spark be passed through a volume of oxygen and hydrogen gas, it becomes water, which weighs precisely as much as the volume of the two gases of which it is composed. It is oxygen and hydrogen in combination, and nothing more. Yet the properties of the water are entirely different from those of the oxygen and hydrogen. In like manner, there is a great difference between the properties of the carbonic acid, the water, and the ammonia, of which the plant is composed, and the living plant itself. But as it would be unphilosophical to assume the existence of an unknown something called a quantity to account for the difference between water and its elements, it is no less unphilosophical to assume the existence of an unknown something called vitality to account for the difference between it and the lifeless materials of which living matter is composed. Animal life. In like manner, all the phenomena of animal life are referred to the physical forces inseparable from the matter which composes the animal structure. It is true that functions of matter in the animal tissues are higher than in those of the plant. But the advocates of the theory under consideration endeavor to reduce the difference between animal and vegetable life to a minimum. It is only the upper surface of the leaf which is susceptible of the peculiar effects of light. So it is only the optic nerve that is affected in a way which is necessary to vision. The sensitive plant contracts when touched. And so does the animal muscle when the proper stimulus, nervous or electric, is applied. In short, as all the operations of vegetable life are due to physical forces, so all the phenomena of animal life are due to the same causes. On this subject, Professor Huxley says the matter of life is composed of ordinary matter, differing from it only in the manner in which its atoms are aggregated. It is built up of ordinary matter, and again resolved into ordinary matter when its work is done. 208 By protoplasm, or matter of life, he sometimes means matter which exhibits the phenomena of life. And sometimes, matter which having been elaborated by the plant or animal, is capable of supporting life. Hence he calls boiled mutton protoplasm. The only difference between inorganic, lifeless matter, and living plants or animals, is in the manner in which their atoms are aggregated. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen are all lifeless bodies. Of these, carbon and oxygen unite, in certain proportions, and under certain conditions, to give rise to carbonic acid. Hydrogen and oxygen produce water. Nitrogen and hydrogen give rise to ammonia. These new compounds, like the elementary bodies of which they are composed, are lifeless. But when they are brought together, under certain conditions they give rise to the still more complex body, protoplasm, and this protoplasm exhibits the phenomena of life. I see no break in this series of steps in molecular complication, and I am unable to understand why the language which is applicable to any one term of the series may not be used to any of the others, when hydrogen and oxygen are mixed in a certain proportion, and an electric spark is passed through them, they disappear, and a quantity of water, equal in weight to the sum of their weights, appears in their place. There is not the slightest parity between the passive and active powers of the water and those of the oxygen and hydrogen which have given rise to it. 209. What justification is there, then, for the assumption of the existence in the living matter of a something which has no representative, or correlative, in the not living matter which gave rise to it? What better philosophical status has vitality than a quantity? And why should vitality hope for a better fate than the other itish which have disappeared since Martinus Scriblerus accounted for the operation of the meat jack by its inherent meat roasting quality, and scorned the materialism of those who explain the turning of the spit by a certain mechanism worked by the draft of the chimney? If the properties of water may be properly said to result from the nature and disposition of its component molecules, I can find no intelligible ground for refusing to say that the properties of protoplasm result from the nature and disposition of its molecules. 210. The doctrine, therefore, is that carbonic acid, water, and ammonia, lifeless bodies, under certain conditions, become living matter, not in virtue of any new force or principle communicated to them, but solely in virtue of a different arrangement of their molecules. of this living matter all plants and animals are composed, and to the properties or physical forces inherent in the matter of which they are composed, all the phenomena of vegetable and animal life are to be referred. Protoplasm, says Professor Huxley, is the clay of the potter which, bake it and paint it as he will, remains clay, separated by artifice and not by nature, from the commonest brick or sun-dried clod. 211 is the brick, no matter what its shape or color, can have no properties not inherent in the clay, so vegetable or animal organisms can have no properties which do not belong to protoplasm, which, in the last analysis, is nothing but carbonic acid, water, and ammonia. Professor Huxley is not only a distinguished naturalist, but a popular lecturer and preacher of lay sermons, and thus has become a representative man among the advocates of this new form of materialism. He is, however, very far from standing alone. Some of the most distinguished living physicists, chemists, and naturalists, says Dr. Beale, have accepted this physical theory of life. They have taught that life is but a mode of ordinary force, and that the living thing differs from the non-living thing, not in quality, or essence, or kind, but merely in degree. 212 So long, says the same writer, as the advocates of the physical doctrine of life contented themselves with ridiculing vitality as a fiction and a myth, because it could not be made evident to the senses, measured or weighed, or proved scientifically to exist, their position was not easily assailed. But now when they assert dogmatically that vital force is only a form or mode of ordinary motion, they are bound to show that the assertion rests upon evidence, or it will be regarded by thoughtful men as one of a large number of fanciful hypotheses, advocated only by those who desire to swell the ranks of the teachers and expounders of dogmatic science, which, although pretentious and authoritative, must ever be intolerant and unprogressive. 213. Mental phenomena. Not only are the operations of vegetable and animal life, according to the new doctrine, due to physical forces, but the same is true of all mental operations. If the argument from analogy is valid in the one case, it is valid in the other. If we must believe that the properties of protoplasm, or living matter, are to be referred to the mode in which its molecules are aggregated, because the properties of water are due to the peculiar aggregation of the atoms of which its elements, hydrogen and oxygen, are composed. Then we must believe that all thought and feeling are due to the molecular composition and movements of the brain atoms. Accordingly, Professor Huxley, after saying that vitality has no better philosophical standing than aquosity, warns his readers that they cannot stop with that admission. I bid you beware, he says, that in accepting these conclusions, you are placing your feet on the first rung of a ladder, which in most people's estimation is the reverse of Jacob's, and leads to the antipodes of heaven. It may seem a small thing to admit that the dull vital actions of a fungus or a foraminifer are the properties of their protoplasm, and are the direct results of the nature of the matter of which they are composed. But if, as I have endeavored to prove to you, their protoplasm is essentially identical with, and most readily converted into, that of any animal, I can discover no logical halting place between the admission that such is the case, and the further concession that all vital action may with equal propriety be said to be the result of the molecular forces of the protoplasm which displays it. And if so, it must be true, in the same sense and to the same extent, that the thoughts to which I am now giving utterance, and your thoughts regarding them, are the expression of molecular changes in that matter of life which is the source of our other vital phenomena. 214 Further, he says, I take it to be demonstrable that it is utterly impossible to prove that anything whatever may not be the effect of a material and necessary cause, and that human logic is equally incompetent to prove that any act is really spontaneous. A really spontaneous act is one which, by the assumption, has no cause, that is, no material cause, for he admits no other. And the attempt to prove such a negative as this is, on the face of the matter, absurd. And while it is thus a philosophical impossibility to demonstrate that any given phenomenon is not the effect of a material cause, anyone who is acquainted with the history of science will admit that its progress has in all ages meant, and now more than ever means, the extension of the province of what we call matter and causation, and the concomitant gradual banishment from all regions of human thought of what we call spirit and spontaneity. 215 After all, What do we know of this terrible matter, except as a name for the unknown and hypothetical cause of states of our own consciousness? And what do we know of that spirit over whose threatened extinction by matter a great lamentation is arising, except that it is also a name for an unknown and hypothetical cause or condition of states of consciousness? In other words, matter and spirit are but names for the imaginary substrata of groups of natural phenomena. 216. As surely as every future grows out of past and present, so will the physiology of the future gradually extend the realm of matter and law until it is coextensive with knowledge, with feeling, and with action. 217. He cites the often quoted exhortation of Hume, and enforces the most wise advice which it contains. If we take in our hand, says Hume, any volume of divinity or school metaphysics, for instance, let us ask, does it contain any abstract reasoning concerning quantity or number? No. Does it contain any experimental reasoning concerning matter of fact or existence? No. Commit it, then, to the flames. For it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. 218. The history of human speculation does not furnish a more explicit avowal of materialism than that contained in the above quotations. All known effects are ascribed to material causes. Spirit is declared to have only an imaginary existence. Spontaneity is pronounced an absurdity. Necessity is affirmed to be inexorable and universal. Yet Huxley says he is no materialist. This, in a sense, is true. He is not a materialist, because he believes in neither matter nor spirit. He avows himself a disciple of Hume, who taught that we know nothing but impressions and ideas. Substance, whether material or spiritual, efficiency, and God, are banished from the sphere of knowledge to that of sophistry and illusion. He avows his fellowship with Herbert Spencer, the fundamental principle of whose new philosophy is, that all we know, or can know, is, that force is and that it is persistent, while force itself is absolutely inscrutable. This blots the soul and God out of existence, except as those words indicate an unknown force. But as he also holds that all forces are convertible, the distinction between material and mental forces, whether human or divine, is obliterated. He avails himself of the common assumption that his theory does not degrade spirit, but exalts matter. It is the verdict of history, however, as Julius Amler truly says, that every attempt to spiritualize matter ends in materializing spirit. On this subject, Spencer says men who have not risen above that vulgar conception which unites with matter the contemptuous epithets gross and brute, may naturally feel dismay at the proposal to reduce the phenomena of life, of mind, and of society, to a level with those which they think so degraded. The course proposed does not imply a degradation of the so-called higher, but an elevation of the so-called lower. 219. This at least is an avowal that the phenomena of life, mind, and society are to be referred to material or physical causes. This, indeed, he repeatedly asserts. After insisting on the transformation of physical forces into chemical, and these into vital, he adds, many will be alarmed by the assertion that the forces which we distinguish as mental, come within the same generalization. Yet there is no alternative but to make this concession. 220. Any hesitation to admit that between the physical forces and the sensations there exists a correlation like that between the physical forces themselves, must disappear on remembering how the one correlation like the other, is not qualitative only, but quantitative. 221. Various classes of facts unite to prove that the law of metamorphosis, which holds among the physical forces, holds equally between them and the mental forces, how this metamorphosis takes place, how a force existing as motion, light, or heat, can become a mode of consciousness, is mysterious. But he adds, it is not a greater mystery than the transformations of physical forces into each other. 222. Dr. Maudsley, a distinguished writer of the same school, 223 says, few, if any, will now be found to deny that with each display of mental power there are correlative changes in the material substratum. That every phenomenon of mind is the result, as manifest in energy, of some change, molecular, chemical, or vital, in the nervous elements of the brain. Again, he says, 224 with regard to the manifold phenomena of mind. By observation of them, an abstraction from the particular, we get the general conception, or the essential idea of mind, an idea which has no more existence out of the mind than any other abstract idea or general term. In virtue, however, of that powerful tendency in the human mind to make the reality conformable to the idea, a tendency which has been at the bottom of so much confusion in philosophy, this general conception has been converted into an objective entity, and allowed to tyrannize over the understanding. A metaphysical abstraction has been made into a spiritual entity and a complete barrier thereby interposed in the way of positive investigation. The passages quoted above are a fair specimen of the kind of reasoning in which scientific men frequently indulge. In the first quotation, there are two clauses presented as equivalent, which are in fact essentially different. And substituting the one for the other is just a silent and subtle begging of the question. The first says that every mental act is attended by a molecular change in the brain. The other in effect says, the molecular change is the mental act. These two propositions are as different as day and night. The theory is that a certain kind of molecular motion in iron is heat, and a certain kind of molecular motion in the brain is thought. And all the proof, as far as the latter is concerned, is that the one attends the other. But the formation of an image on the retina attends sight, and yet does not prove that the image is our consciousness when we see. Again, in the second passage, Dr. Maudsley says that mind is an abstract idea, which has no existence outside of the mind, that is outside of itself. An abstract idea has an abstract idea, which it makes into an objective entity. Men who deny the objective existence of mind can no more think, speak, or write without recognizing its existence than an idealist can act without recognizing the existence of the external world. Any theory which involves a denial of the laws of our nature is of necessity absurd. The German physicists. As might be expected, the scientific men of the continent are more outspoken in their materialism than those of England. A late German writer, T.H. Otto Berger, Oberlehrer für Mathematik und Physik, 225, says materialism is the philosophy of the five senses. It admits nothing but on the testimony of sensation, and therefore denies the existence of the soul, of God, and of everything supersensuous. In its modern form, it teaches that as the material is alone true and real, it is uncreated and eternal. It always has been and always will be. It is indestructible, and, in its elements, unchangeable. Force is inseparable from matter. According to the theory, no matter is without force, and no force is without matter. No force exists of itself. And, therefore, there is none to which the creation of matter is to be referred. The universe as it now is due to the gradual evolution of the two elements, matter and force, which evolution proceeds under the operation of fixed laws. The lower organisms are first formed, then the higher, until man appears. All life, whether animal, vegetable, or spiritual, is due to the working of physical and chemical forces in matter. As no power exists but in matter, there can be no divine being with creative power nor any created human soul. Berger quotes Virgil as saying, "The scientific naturalist knows only bodies and the properties of bodies. All that is beyond them he pronounces transcendental, and the transcendental is the chimerical." He also quotes B100 Vogt as saying, "We admit of no creator, either in the beginning, or in the course of the world's history, and regard the idea of a self-conscious, extra-mundane creator as ridiculous. Man, according to these writers, consists only of a material body. All mental acts and states are of the brain. When the body dies, the man ceases to exist. The only immortality, says Maleschet, is that when the body is disintegrated, its ammonia, carbonic acid, and lime serve to enrich the earth and to nourish plants, which feed other generations of men." 226. F. Refutation. As materialism, in its modern form, in all that is essential to the theory, is the same that it was 1,000 years ago, the old arguments against it are as available now as they ever were. Its fundamental affirmation is that all the phenomena of the universe, physical, vital, and mental, are to be referred to an intelligent physical forces. And its fundamental negation is that there is no such objective entity as mind or spirit.
If, therefore, it can be shown that an intelligent force cannot account for all the phenomena of the universe, and that there is such an objective entity or substance as mind, the theory is refuted. There are two methods of combating any given theory. The one is the scientific, which calls in question the accuracy or the completeness of the data on which it is founded, or the validity of the inferences deduced from them. The other is the shorter and easier method of the reductio ad absurdum. The latter is just as legitimate and valid as the former. It is to be remembered that every theory includes two factors: facts and principles, or facts and inferences drawn from them. The facts may be admitted when the principles or inferences may be denied. Thus the facts on which materialists insist may, for the most part at least, be acknowledged, while the sweeping inferences which they draw from them, in the eye of reason, may not be worth a straw. All such inferences must be rejected whenever they conflict with any well-established truth, whether of intuition, experience, or of divine revelation. Three general theories have been proposed to solve the great problem of the universe: the materialistic, the pantheistic, and the deistic. According to the first, all the phenomena of the universe are due to matter and its forces. According to the second, in its most rational form, all power, activity, and life are the power, activity, and life of the one universal mind. The third, or deistic theory, assumes the existence of an infinite, extra-mundane God, who created matter, endowed with forces, and finite minds gifted with intelligence and will, and that all the ordinary phenomena of the universe are approximately due to these physical and mental forces as constantly upheld and controlled by the omnipresent wisdom and power of God. It may be doubted whether any amount of argument can deepen the conviction that the deistic solution of this great problem is the true one. It is seen to be true, because it is seen to be a solution. It satisfactorily accounts for all the facts of consciousness and observation. It satisfies the reason, the heart, and the conscience. It is in fact self-evidently true, in the sense that no man to whom it has been once proposed can ever permanently shake off the conviction of its truth. The other theories are not solutions. They may account for some classes of facts, but not for others. Our present concern, however, is with materialism. Materialism contradicts the facts of consciousness. 1. The primary principle of all knowledge is the knowledge of self. This must be assumed. Unless we are, we cannot know. This knowledge of self is a knowledge that we are something, a real existence, not merely a state or mode of something else, but that the self is a substance, a real, objective entity. It is, moreover, a knowledge not only that we are a substance, but also that we are an individual subsistence, which thinks, feels, and wills. Here, then, is mind, that is an individual, intelligent, voluntary agent, necessarily included in the first, and the most essential of all truths. If this be denied, then Hume is right, and we can know nothing. It is, moreover, included in this knowledge of the self, that the body is not the ego. Although the body is intimately, and even vitally united to the substance in which our personality resides, it is nevertheless objective to it. It is the organ which the self uses, and by which it holds communion with the external world. That these are really facts of consciousness, and not merely dicta, or arbitrary assumptions, is clear because they are universally and of necessity recognized. They are embedded in all human languages. They are involved in all expressions of human thought. They are of necessity assumed by those who theoretically deny them. The materialist cannot think, or speak, or write, without assuming the existence of mind as distinct from matter, any more than the idealist can live and act without assuming the existence of the external world. Our knowledge of mind, therefore, as a thinking substance, is the first, and most certain, and the most indestructible of all forms of knowledge. Because it is involved in self-knowledge, or self-consciousness, which is the indispensable condition of all knowledge. That which knows is, in the order of nature, before that which is known. It is impossible, therefore, that the materialist can have any higher evidence of the existence of matter, or of force, than that which every man has, in his own consciousness, of the existence of mind. To deny the one is as unreasonable as to deny the other. neither can be denied, except theoretically. As a matter of fact, every man believes in matter, and every man believes in mind. What are our sensations which are relied upon so confidently to give us knowledge of physical phenomena, but states of consciousness? If consciousness is to be trusted in reporting the testimony of the senses, why is it not to be trusted when it reports the facts of our interior life? If it is believed when it says there is something visible and tangible without us, why should it not be believed when it says there is something which thinks and wills within us? If unreliable in the one case, it is unreliable in the other. And if unreliable in either, the whole foundation of knowledge and of all faith is swept away. Confidence in the veracity of consciousness is our only security from the wildest, the most irrational, and the most degrading skepticism. It may be said, however, that the materialist does not deny that there is something within us that thinks and wills. He only says that that something is the brain. This, however, is to ignore one half of the testimony which consciousness really bears. It testifies not only that there are such sensations as those of sight and touch, but that there is a real objective substance which is tangible and visible. That is to say, we believe in virtue of the constitution of our nature, and therefore of necessity, when we see or touch, that the objects of our sense perceptions have a real, objective existence. This every man believes, and cannot help believing. And in like manner, when he thinks, feels, or wills, he believes, in virtue of the constitution of his nature, and therefore by a like necessity, that he himself is an intelligent, feeling, and voluntary substance. That is, he believes that the self is mind, or spirit, to which the body is objective, and therefore different from the self. The belief in mind, therefore, is involved in the belief of self-existence. Consciousness gives us the assurance that the self is an intelligent, voluntary agent, or spirit. 2. Another fact of consciousness which materialism denies, either avowedly or by necessary implication, is the fact of reagency. This, indeed, is involved in what has already been said. Nevertheless, there are those who admit the existence of mind who deny that man is a free agent. It needs no proof that consciousness attests that men have the power of self-determination. Every man knows this to be true with regard to himself. Every man recognizes the fact with regard to his fellow men. This again is a conviction which no obduracy of the conscience, and no sophistry of argument can permanently obliterate from the human mind. This, however, materialism denies. Physical forces act necessarily and uniformly. In referring all mental action to physical forces, materialism cannot but exclude all freedom of action. There is no spontaneity in chemical affinity, in light, heat, or electricity. Yet to these forces all vital and mental phenomena are referred. If thought be a certain kind of molecular motion of the brain, it is no more free than that other kind of molecular motion called heat. And this is the more obviously true, if they are correlative, the one being changed into the other. Accordingly, materialists, as a general thing, are avowed necessitarians. This is not only true of the positivists, but the doctrine that human action is determined by necessary laws, is the foundation of their whole system of social science. And Professor Huxley, as we have seen, pronounces a spontaneous act, from the nature of the case, an absurdity. It is for him a causeless effect. Every man, therefore, who knows that he is a free agent, knows that materialism cannot be true. 3. Materialism contradicts the facts of our moral and religious consciousness. Our moral perceptions are the clearest, the most certain, and the most authoritative of all of our cognitions. If a man is shut up to deny either the testimony of his senses or the truths of reason, on the one hand, or the testimony of his moral nature on the other, all experience shows that he will give up sense and reason, and bow to the authority of conscience. He cannot help it. No man can free himself from the sense of sin, or of accountability. These moral convictions involve in them, or, at least, necessitate the belief in a God to whom we must give an account. But materialism, in banishing all mind in man, leaves nothing to be accountable. And in banishing all mind from the universe, leaves no being to whom an account can be rendered. To substitute for an intelligent, extra-mundane, personal God, mere inscrutable force, is a mockery, an insult. Our whole moral and religious nature declares any such theory to be false. It cannot be true unless our whole nature be a lie. And our nature cannot be a lie, unless, as Sir William Hamilton says, the whole universe be a dream of a dream. To call upon men to worship gravitation, and sing hallelujahs to the whirlwind, is to call upon them to durationalize themselves. The attempt is as idle as it is foolish and wicked. This argument from the facts of consciousness against materialism is met by the assertion that consciousness is not to be trusted. Dr. Maudsley devotes the greater part of the first chapter of his book on the physiology of the mind to the establishment of this point. He argues that self-consciousness is unreliable in the information which it does give, and incompetent to give any account of a large part of our mental activity. LT gives no account of the mental phenomena of the infant, of the uncultivated adult, and of the insane. No account of the bodily conditions which underlie every mental manifestation. No account of the large field of unconscious mental action exhibited, not only in the unconscious assimilation of impressions, but in the registrations of ideas and of their associations, in their latent existence and influence when not active, and their recall into activity. And no account of the influence organically exerted on the brain by other organs of the body. That is, consciousness does not tell us all things, and sometimes tells us wrong. Cannot the same be said of the senses? Can they inform us of everything which goes on in the body? Do they not often deceive us? Are not the sensations of the delirious and the maniac altogether untrustworthy? Does it follow from this that our senses are never to be relied upon? What then becomes of the physical sciences, which are founded on the trustworthiness of the senses? The fact is that if the testimony of consciousness is not to be received as to our mental operations, it cannot be received as to our sensations. If we have no trustworthy evidence of the existence of mind, we have no valid evidence of the existence of matter. And there is no universe, no God. All is nothing. Happily, men cannot emancipate themselves from the laws of their nature. They cannot help believing the well-attested testimony of their senses, and they cannot help believing the testimony of consciousness as to their personal identity, and as to the real, objective existence of the soul as the subject of their thoughts, feelings, and volitions. As no man can refuse to believe that he has a body, so no man can refuse to believe that he has a soul, and that the two are distinct as the self and the not-self.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwaters Revival Books.